Hello and welcome to episode 16 of Chicago Business Podcast, where we introduce leading executives in the area and learn about how they are innovating with their businesses. I am your host, Drew Sekula, and today we welcome Ryan Walsh, co-founder and chief executive officer of Valkari, based here in Chicago. Valkari is a drone delivery solution company that was just named North America's best tech startup in the 2020 Timmy Awards by Tech in Motion just last week. Hello, Ryan. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me, Drew. It's an honor to be on here.
Yeah, it's great. Great to have you here. So, and congrats on that award. That's pretty timely that we have you on here just a couple of days later.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, we applied and we were, you know, hoping for the best, but get selected as best tech startup across the whole continent. That's kind of crazy.
Yeah, that really is that really is something. I know that you were what, first the winner here in Chicagoland, and then they opened it up across North America. Is that right?
Yep. There was 11 cities, I believe, and they selected the top one from each city, and then all of them went to the finals, and we have to thank everybody that voted for us and the judges and everybody else, because we got selected. And so it was very humbling, and we're eternally grateful for the experience.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Not the first awards that you guys have been a part of, though. I was just in a little research. I saw that you were also named Built in Chicago's 50 Startups to Watch for this year as well. So you guys have gotten a fair amount of press.
Yeah, we've, the market's been heating up, drone deliveries, really taking huge strides. It seems like the industry's growing exponentially every year, but, COVID especially has really highlighted a lot of, why we need contactless, touchless delivery. And a lot of people that, weren't big proponents of the technology even last year are now seeing a need with COVID. So it's, really gained us a lot of attention, and we're very thankful for it.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I can see how there's definitely a push in that direction, and obviously the whole touchless system, there's a lot to be said for in today's day and age. But before we get too much further, I'd like to start us with a little icebreaker there with the beverage of the day. So I think you have one picked out. What do you have for us?
A Mountain Dew.
Nice. Well, I'm joining you with it as well.
Awesome.
What's your, is that something you picked up in the armed forces, or was it go back to being a kid?
That's something as a kid. I probably drank way too many of these things every day when I was a teenager, playing my video games, drinking Mountain Dew, being a cliche.
Nice. Well, I haven't had one in a while, but I'll join you. I loaded mine up with ice cubes, though, just in case. Cut it down a little bit. But very good. Well, yeah, maybe let's start with a little bit of your origin story, your background, and talk about that. So I know you guys are based in Chicago now, but is this where you're born and raised, or let's start there? Yeah.
I was born in Chicago, raised in the suburbs. My parents moved out when I was young, and relatively normal, life. I mean, ups and downs like anything else, but, I realized pretty early on that I didn't really want to go the traditional route. We had just invaded Iraq when I was in my senior year, and so, at 17, that seemed like a little bit more of an adventure than going to college. So 17, I signed up and, I said, let me get the first plane over to the war. And so they said, oh, you want to try out and be a Ranger then? So I tried out and I made it, and they sent me to Afghanistan and Iraq and all of that. And so I did the military for a couple of years. And then I'd gotten out. I kind of got what I wanted, for good or for worse, while I was in. You go in thinking it's going to be a lot more like the commercials you see, and then you get much more of a realistic picture of just the nature of combat and the things over there. And so you it definitely kind of skewed my perspective on things a little bit. One of the biggest things for me was, you know, we were getting put in, you know, gunfights every day and all this, you know, danger and getting put in harm's way. But it seemed like the people that were really, you know, saw the opportunities, right? It wasn't the soldiers, it wasn't the Afghan or the Iraq people. It was, you know, the people getting those government contracts, doing the business over there. And it showed me that it was much more of a business than just a, you know, combat situation. So I was not expecting to get out of the military when I signed up. I thought I would be in there for my life. But then I realized that business is really where things were actually happening. So I got out, went and got my undergrad at Northeastern Illinois University, over in the city, and then started my first company at 24. Went back to night school for my MBA at 25. I was just kind of starting a number of different small businesses through my 20s until Alex and I came up with the idea behind Valkyrie. I think I was 27 at the time. And so we started working pretty diligently on that as things picked up. And that was really 2013, 2014 when that started.
So how'd you come up with the idea for it then? So it's not something you found on the battlefield, but instead something when you came back and just looking at the market and how'd you come up with the idea?
So I learned quite a bit about small unit tactics and special operations being a Ranger, you know, really taking on the guerrilla warfare mentality and force multiplying. It wasn't until I got out and really started looking, I got my undergrad degree in economics and then my MBA, right? So it gave me a very unique perspective on almost operating in that same small unit guerrilla mentality for business. And so, you know, when Alex and I were coming up with different things we wanted to work on, we would brainstorm. No idea was too crazy. Nothing was too far out there. And we would start with an idea, an assumption, whatever it may be, and poke holes until there's nothing left. And so we've done this exercise many, many times. It's, you know, really how we decide how to move forward with a deal or not. When we started looking at drones in 2013, there was murmurs that, you know, different companies and different organizations were starting to take it a little more seriously. Now, being in special operations, I got to really see a lot of the technology develop, right? I mean, when I first joined, we first invaded Iraq, you know, you had Predator drones and things like that. But by the time I had gotten out just a few years later, you had, you know, Reaper gunships and all these different things and just seeing that development. So once I was able to really kind of analyze it and put that against my economics, you know, degree and the schooling that I learned there, I was able to really see, you know, the 20-year lead time on these military technologies to civilian market based on, you know, proliferation between miniaturization, cost reduction, economies of scale, you name it, right? And so there tended to be this 2-decade lead time from the time something hit the military in the front lines to when it was widely available for everybody. And so seeing is how, you know, the shifts, the industrial revolutions, right? I mean, we went through the dot-com and everything else, and you can see, you know, the guys who come in on the earlier side of this tend to do a lot better than the guys who are late stage, right? So we made our criteria. We wanted to come in on an early stage new technology, one where there was going to be quite a bit of, you know, blue ocean, quite a bit of, you know, protection, something in hardware. With the Alice v. CLS court decision, it made it very hard to protect the software, right? So, you know, something we could protect in a hardware sense, something that we could, you know, really take advantage of an international market that was on the cutting edge. And so all of these things really aligned when we started looking at drones in 2013. And so we saw You know, we had enough time to develop the technology before mainstream adoption. We were still early on the investment curve, and the innovation steps and the innovation curve were still very early on. So it gave us a lot of market shaping power. So it was really just a confluence of strategy, tactics, and, you know, just good old fashioned putting our minds to work on something.
Nice. Well, I'd be remiss not to to allow this to go any further without first thanking you for your service. So thank you very much for having done that. And obviously this world would not be the same without people like you stepping up. So very much appreciated. Maybe we can take a step back though and explain a little bit about what your product actually is, because it's not the drones themselves, right?
Right. So we started with just the basic premise of, if these drones are going to be delivering packages, how do you as an everyday consumer interact with them, right? Because you've got multiple spinning blades, it's aviation, there's a lot of extra, you know, concerns that need to be put into this. So we started building drone delivery mailboxes. We started filing patents on drone delivery mailboxes and, different variations and aspects of it. And as we started going down, how does this work? What systems need to be in place? How does it, you know, talk to the consumer? We started finding there was a whole lot of questions that nobody had answered yet. And so we started, you know, inventing technologies and answering those questions to really build a solution where you can order an Uber Eats drone to deliver you McDonald's, and you can get a package delivered by an Amazon drone, and your mailman can drive up and put the mail in just like he has been, right? So being able to serve all of those needs for a single customer, we started, you know, just building around those prerequisites. And so it was, a lot more questions than answers in the beginning, but you'd go through an iteration, you'd prototype, and you'd figure out what worked, what didn't, and you'd keep doing it and keep doing it until you got something close to where you needed to be, right? So, it was a tough development, but, you know, now we can comfortably say we have built universal infrastructure that can take packages from any drone or traditional delivery.
Yeah, that's great. It seems like a nice position to be at. I would expect that the drones themselves have to be, you know, incredibly competitive in that area in terms of all the different competing solutions there. But I'm very interested to hear a little bit more about the intellectual property you developed around that delivery system. So you guys basically make their receptacles, right? And that include a landing pad, or maybe just explain a little bit more.
Sure. So it's, think of like a mailbox with a landing pad on top, right? So we started with the mailbox version, which is very simply a mailbox with a landing pad built into the top. And so all of it goes into one storage receptacle, as well as window units. And we recently announced our drone delivery station, which is a 7.5 foot tall community locker style. And so they all interact with any drone. To your point, when we were looking at the market, right, drones, they're using a lot of the same technology that helicopters have been using since the 50s, right? There's a handful of, you know, marginal improvements, but it's not reinventing the wheel, right? And so when we were doing our early analysis, we realized the drone is where there's going to be just a bloodbath in the market. Everybody and their brother is going to make a drone, right? And we just saw that. I got at the recent Shenzhen drone show or electronic show, there was over 1,000 different drone platforms at just one show, right? So everybody is building their own, you know, variation of it. What we wanted to do, and it's always been a principle of mine, if everybody's digging for gold, sell pickaxes, don't try and dig for gold, right? So if everybody's making competing drone platforms, the key is how do you interact with them all at a universal application, right? And so that's really where we saw that market and we saw that opening. And so we started filing patents around our patent applications around that. The IP we built was really the cornerstone built around the hardware and the mailbox and the window and the different derivations of that. And then you start getting into the systems and everything else, right? So our invention is covered by about 45% of the world's population is where we have patent coverage. You know, slight nuances country to country, but for the most part, it's a box with a door on top. I mean, it's about as broad as it gets, right? It covers just about every possible inclusion of any kind of landing receptacle. You know, some of our other countries, Europe, countries within Europe, China, Australia, Canada have extremely broad claims, and we feel our IP is going to completely block the market. So we have the system around the box itself, but also the method of delivering by aerial vehicle to a landing pad receptacle.
So is the technology now basically ready to go, or what challenges remain in this all coming to fruition and actually seeing drone deliveries occur? Or is it actually up and running in certain areas?
It is up and running. There's pilots in many, many areas in the US and the world. Drone delivery is, it's going to be iterations, right? So up until 2018, we really saw the concentration being on the drone. And the business cases that were emerging were the ones that solely relied on the drone. Your mapping, your inspection, your imagery, your things like that, right? Once we established over 2013 to 2015, or 2018, I'm sorry, and not we as Valkyrie, but we as an industry, established that the drone technology is there. 2019 and 2020 have really been spent on traffic management and connectivity, right? You'll see the FAA is doing a lot of work with a number of companies, T-Mobile, our partners, Amazon, a bunch of other companies to figure out the remote identification so the drones can safely integrate with current airspace, right? And then 2021 and beyond is really the phase three stuff. That's when it starts getting really almost Star Trek-y and fun. But that's where infrastructure and support pieces like recharging and different things start coming into play. And that's when delivery really starts opening up, right? So the deliveries that are happening now in these pilots are very much, you know, you have a drone and it'll fly, you know, a couple miles and tether or land or drop something off to you, but it's not a fully autonomous, sustainable system yet, right? Once you add in the recharging, like some of our partners and you know, our landing stations and the traffic management and all of this, that's really going to be integrating over this next year. It's really going to pave the way for you know, the FAA is going to be announcing updates in 2022, 2023, 2024, and we're really expecting 2023 to be the big explosion year. But for the next year or two, it's really going to be focused on integrating all these technologies. So if you're in a particular market that happens to have a pilot going on, you know, you'll be able to get it. But it'll be about 2 to 3 years before everybody in, you know, most of the developed world will be able to order a package by drone.
Yeah. And there's still probably a wide range of, you know, people in terms of what it makes sense for. Like in certain communities, I would think they wouldn't necessarily need a locked reciprocal for a receptacle, excuse me, for a delivery to take place, right? If it is, and then in the cities, they create their own, they have their own issues. But I guess your solution is it meant for a particular niche of the market, or I see a wide application there, I guess.
So there's a lot of applications for drones, but I get asked the question all the time, are drones going to replace UPS trucks, right? And the answer is no, right? I mean, there's not going to be a replacement of anything, right? Drones are really an additional layer, right? And so it makes a lot of sense in a situation where I am ordering Uber Eats, right? From McDonald's, right? It's going from one point to another point and it's only one item, right? That makes sense for a drone delivery. Medical deliveries almost always make sense for individual patient care for drone deliveries, right? What doesn't make sense is the UPS model, for instance, right? If I'm going and doing a milk run and driving one big circle for the day, right? It doesn't make sense to go back and forth like you would with a drone. You want a truck that can go point to point to point and drop each package off. And then there's plenty of cool solutions out there like Workhorse and some of the other ones that you can actually launch drones from these trucks and have a hybrid model. So there's a lot of different ways where drones are a better solution than what we currently have, but they're not a one shot fits all for every solution, right? It's just to deburden a lot of where the last mile logistics currently gets clogged up. And I think that's where drones make the most sense. Now, for us, you know, there's specific instances where, sure, you know, you might want the drone to deliver it directly to you, but more likely than not, that's rarely going to be the case, right? And one of the big issues we saw with drone delivery in the early days, if I'm at work or whenever I order anything, if it's anything but a meal, chances are it's getting ordered and it's coming when it's coming. And, you know, I'll get it in my mailbox or on my front step or whatever it may be when I get home. Right. But I'm not sitting at home all day waiting for packages. Right. That's not the best use of mine or anybody else's time. Right. So the market for us is really any time you want to do this and it's convenient. Right. If the package is left on my driveway and it's either going to be damaged, stolen, or I have to be in my driveway, it's not solving that urgent, convenient, you know, the entire thing that drones are going to be doing. It takes a lot of that away, right? So our market is really focusing in on building that convenience and building that security. And there's not too many use cases where you don't need that.
Right. So approximately, like, what size are these, is the equipment that you put in, and then how do you deal with kind of the rights of where you put it and who pays for it?
So there's a few questions. That's definitely a loaded question there, right? Now, most of the time it's the property owners, right? We're looking to replace a lot of traditional mailboxes and serve the purposes, both a mailbox and a drone landing station. So most of the times it's pretty clear cut as to where you're putting it and the property rights and everything else, right? You know, it's definitely not something we're forcing onto people's property, right? It's something they would need. So a lot of those are getting worked out. Now, one of the big issues that we found, and this was in our first mailbox iteration, right? I made a bunch of cardboard mock-ups and put them out in my front yard. And I looked at what is the biggest size that meets postal code, that has the most storage space, but isn't obtrusive, right? If the wife doesn't put it in front of her house, I'll never sell a single one, right? So we really were focusing on the aesthetics, the overall, you know, just how much of an eyesore was it? How much can we do to blend it in through, you know, paneling and finishing and different things to make it blend in? And then we actually built it, right? And then we tested it only to find out that what would meaningfully not be an eyesore in your front yard ends up not being a very big drone delivery station. And so a lot of our work is, you know, figuring out these past couple of years of what is reasonable to expect somebody to want to put in their front house while still being able to meet the needs of the drone delivery. And so it's a very, very fine balancing act. And my engineering team is doing phenomenal things in putting those together. But I don't know that I quite have an answer. And we're looking at some pretty creative solutions right now that, you know, are able to be very compact when not in use, but serve the needs of the drones when they are in use. And so, you know, we'll probably be unveiling that sometime in 2021. But I do believe we have a very interesting and creative solution to keep it low profile and still serve the needs of the drone delivery. So TBD on that one right now.
Right. No, those are some real challenges, obviously. And I can see that balance. And I guess you could put it in the backyard, but then it doesn't work for your postal service, right? So
yeah, that's an option. And we also have our window units. You could stick it in a second floor window. I mean, sometimes that's even a better option for keeping it away from where the kids play and everything else, right? So, you know, our goal is to use our technology, and whether it's a mailbox or a window unit or whatever, having a solution for any customer, no matter if you live in the city and the very rural areas, if you have, you know, a lot of deliveries or you have few, we want to have a solution for everybody.
Right. And you have multi-unit solutions as well, right? So some of them accommodate multiple lockers.
Yep. Yeah, and you can send packages or receive packages from any one of those lockers, so it can coordinate multiple delivery lines at once.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a price range that you can share just to give people an idea of what something like that would cost to put in? To get installed?
Sure. So the commercial boxes tend to be a little bit more expensive. I mean, being 7.5 feet tall and all of that, there's a lot of moving pieces. We actually just signed a manufacturing deal with our partners, Ag Eagle. So we could build in larger batches for these commercial stations and drive the cost down. Now, we've also been doing the you know, cost of materials on some of the new mailbox stuff my team's working on. It looks like our mailbox will be very much in line with another smart appliance in the home or kitchen. So, you know, pretty much in line with what you'd pay for a, you know, smart fridge, smart stove type of situation. You know, my goal is to not have the cost be a barrier to entry for any customer. So we're still exploring if we're going to be, you know, leasing these or having a monthly leasing cost rather than a, you know, upfront retail cost, or you know, what that pricing model is going to look like. But my end goal is I don't want any customer to not be able to get drone deliveries because they can't afford our box.
Right. Yeah, makes sense. Let's talk about some of your partners. And I know you mentioned T-Mobile. I think I had seen that you guys had announced a deal at Sprint. I'm not sure if that's the same thing. But can you talk a little bit about the partners that you're working with, and then maybe it's a fine line between them and some of the competitors, because I could see how you're, you know, some of the big guys would potentially, you know, they're developing their own solutions as well, right?
Yeah, some of the big guys, you know, we've spoken to them, and a lot of them tend to be very secret, right? They tend to want to do it all in their own ecosystem because they can afford to do it that way. And so a lot of them have, you know, all in one ecosystems, right? Their drone, their software, their everything, right? And that's great. But it makes it very hard to build standards. It makes it very hard when you have something like drones, for instance, where there's a lot of moving pieces, a lot of different solutions that need to be in place at once, from the software, the UTM, landing stations, drones, operator, you name it. So that collaborative and partnering mentality tends to be a lot more fruitful and tends to move a lot quicker than the closed systems. So that's just a fundamental difference that we've taken. We're very open, and we have a number of partners in each area, right? What we found is, you know, it's great to have a partner that, you know, can do X, but if they can only do X under these conditions, you need to be able to do X under the other conditions, right? So sometimes their competitors aren't necessarily the competitors that they think they are, right? They're just a different way of doing it in different parameters. So we partner with a lot of subsystems, and, you know, a recent one, Soteria Battery Group out of the Carolinas. They're a phenomenal company with some really exciting battery technology. Ag Eagle's a recent one we announced out of Wichita, Kansas. You know, they've had a lot of success doing agricultural and imaging and things like that, but they're starting to branch into other areas, and we saw a lot of benefit working with them. You know, so not only are we developing some really cool systems with them, but we're also, you know, doing our manufacturing through them, right? There's a handful of different ones, whether it's UTM, whether it's the drone, right? Even the drone manufacturers, there's, you know, guys that have two or three different products in their line, right? And they're all for, you know, maybe high payload short deliveries, whereas another company is much more geared towards the 100-mile plus drones, right? So having these partners in the wide network we do has really allowed us to almost custom tailor solutions depending on what a customer needs, you know, whether it's a hospital, whether it's, you know, a rural medical network in Africa, whoever's reaching out to us, we don't have to have a one size fits all solution. Every problem is not a nail and we're a hammer, right? We can custom pick which drones, which operators, which connectivity we want to pull in for each one of these. And it's allowed a much more beneficial for both the customer and growing the technology environment. Now, Sprint was probably one of our biggest first customers, right? We did a demo with them about a year ago. It was September 11th of last year. And we demonstrated a delivery over their 5G network by drone. So it was very fun. It was great collaborating with them. They went through the acquisition by T-Mobile, and now they have, you know, many more irons in the fire on the drone front with both of their efforts combined. So we've been very happy with that relationship and that partnership, and we're developing some really cool stuff together. And you know, they're great partners.
Yeah, that's great. And you need a lot of good partners, I think, to pull off all of the moving parts that you guys have there, and just with your positioning in the market, that's you can see how the wireless carriers are right there at the top in terms of critical partners. So very good. In terms of your ownership and the investors, you know, obviously you're one of the co-founders. Costs a lot of money to get a company like this off the ground, or have you raised external capital?
Yeah, a little both, right? You know, starting this in 2013, and you know, the traditional Silicon Valley approach is go get market share and then worry about, you know, the foundation later, right? I don't believe in that philosophy. I believe foundation is everything, and no matter what sport you learned as a kid or whatever, right? Always learn the basics, and you never can learn the basics enough, right? So for us, getting the IP protection was very critical early on. There was no point in building a company we couldn't sustain or protect. And so that was very expensive those first few years. And especially, you know, 2013 to 2017, it was very hard if you weren't a big name to raise capital for drones. It just wasn't a tested market. We were in delivery, which was a very fringe part of the technology at the time. And, you know, we're going up against some big, big players in people's perceptions. So it was, I think I spent $250,000 out of my pocket just going after those first patents before we ever knew if we even had a shot. So it was very, very expensive to bootstrap with patents early on. We started raising a little bit towards 2018, 2019, and this year we've had quite a bit of fundraising. You know, it's the market has gained more appeal and more mainstream adoption, and there's been more just progress across the industry. It's been easier to attract capital, you know, both as an industry and as Valkyrie, you know, but fundraising is never fun. I mean, it's a daunting climb no matter what you're doing.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. How about COVID-19? How is coronavirus, and how have you guys had to adapt your business, and how do you keep things on the rails?
You know, COVID was a very bittersweet pill for us, and, you know, there's no other way to really say it. Obviously, you know, it was terrible for the world. It's been very terrible for a lot of people we know, even team members. You know, my co-founder Alex caught it and was very ill for a while. You know, so there was definitely impacts. Working quarantined and working from home and all of that was very challenging. COVID as a whole really highlighted the need, though, for our technology, right? Being able to, you know, autonomously send a sample from a doctor's office to somebody's house. They take a test, you put it in a mailbox, and it autonomously goes back, gets tested, and you can schedule drugs to be delivered every few hours for the next 2 weeks. I mean, it couldn't be a better situation to highlight the need of what we're doing. So it's been, you know, great from a traction point of view, terrible from a, you know, just empathetic towards the world point of view. You know, we were about to close some significant funding right at the beginning of March. We were maybe 2 weeks away, and the potential investor caught COVID, was on a ventilator, and that was a whole different story. So we had to go back and start looking for funding, and we had a very, very short runway, and we didn't have probably all of our ducks in a row like we probably needed to at the time. And so, you know, it was a challenge. Everybody got their discretionary budget wiped out in March and April, and, you know, raising money was very, very challenging, and we were under a gun. So, you know, it's great to see people adopt the vision that we've put forth. At the same time, it has made everything just infinitely more challenging to accomplish.
Right. Yeah, everybody has been having to figure out and adapt, and that definitely sounds like you guys had to be pretty nimble on your toes there for some period of time, but I guess that's the world we find ourselves in. So very interesting. It's exciting to hear about your business. Where should people look if they want to learn more? I assume your website?
Yeah, valkyrie.com, valkyrie.com. You can see some of our latest videos, some of our partners, a lot of the news that's been announced about us, you know, and meet some of the team members.
Yeah, that's awesome. I was looking through there and seeing you have you're highlighting a lot of your team up there. So that was good to see. Like, yeah, incredible team out there first.
So thankful we have the people we do. We'd be nowhere without them.
Yep, sounds good. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, not really. It's just really an honor being on here and a privilege, and I appreciate you. You know, let me highlight Valkyrie and all the exciting things we're working on.
Yeah, well, keep it up and best of luck.
Thanks, Drew. I really appreciate it.
All right. Take care, Ryan.
Take care.